Why, when we talk about rent today, are we still using terms, tenant, landlord, dating back to the Middle Ages and a feudal system of manors and landed estates? Why do many people have trouble surviving under our current system of rental agreements? And why do many find themselves in court? Joining me to explore a humane right to rental housing is Mitch, clinical professor in the UW Law School and the director of the Economic Justice Institute and Neighborhood Law Clinic. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks for having me.
I should say that you go by just Mitch, so I'm not trying to be rude by leaving out your last name. Any quick reason for joining Cher and Madonna and others and taking one name?
I wish I had their musical talent. That would make for I could do a little song and dance here. But no, I just have one name, and that challenges a lot of people's conceptions, because a lot of people think that everyone has to have two or more names, and that's simply not true. There are a lot of folks who have only one name, and if you go back in history, people only had one name. You know, Johann had a son, and he became Johansson, right? So we can go back in history on the naming conventions and find that the current sort of tradition, if we will, of two names is relatively recent, historically speaking. So I don't have any particular reason to get into, but I just have one name, and that name is Mitch.
Well, looking at your profile on the law school pages and elsewhere, it seems as if your whole career has been devoted to justice, better access to justice, questioning the way things are, you know, not taking something, some convention, some term, some law, and assuming it has to be that way or should be that way. Where do you get this passion for sort of greater justice?
Yeah, that's true. I will share, actually, to connect this up, I was orphaned. And so I had some experience with the legal system as an orphan. And I realized that it could be better. And so I set out to go to law school. I knew that's what I wanted to do in high school, and was able to make that happen, made that a reality, worked a whole lot of jobs, and knew that I wanted to work to make access to justice more of a reality. Currently, it's very hard to access justice, and also make that justice system more, not just more accessible, but work better for people.
That's inspiring. Really. And, I know a couple of the places that I mentioned in the intro that you direct, the Economic Justice Institute and Neighborhood Law Clinic, are trying to reach folks who don't have the ability to afford a private attorney. Can you say anything about those? I know we're going to mostly be talking about rent and rental history, but can you say something about those organizations?
Yeah, very briefly. So out of law school, I started a group called Community Justice Incorporated. It's a nonprofit law firm, provides access to justice for folks on a sliding scale. So it charges, even though it's a nonprofit legal aid organization, charges on folks on what they can pay. So that expands on access by not being solely at the whim of a government grant or a private foundation when that money goes away or becomes less popular. So Community Justice Incorporated is a group that I started back in 2004 and has been running ever since, providing access to justice for thousands of folks. And in about 14 years ago, after being at Community Justice, I came back to the law school where I've run the Neighborhood Law Clinic and recently took over directing the larger umbrella organization of the Economic Justice Institute. Within that umbrella, we have a consumer clinic that does consumer law, so think student loans, payday lending, all sorts of consumer scams, family court clinic, which provides obviously family services, an immigration justice clinic, helping folks with very difficult situations on immigration law, a restraining order clinic, helping out folks with domestic violence situations, my program that does rental housing and employment law rounds out our current sort of set of clinics there.
What do you find yourself getting the most angry about as you're working every day with the Neighborhood Law Clinic and with folks who are coming with these issues that they're having, the struggles they're having, when you see who you're serving and what kinds of problems they face in our court system? I'm just curious what kind of keeps you up at night or gets you
You know, the first thing I'll say is actually something that I don't deal with directly in the neighborhood law clinic, but the immigration system in the country is just so fundamentally wrong that we even have laws that exclude and categorize people differently. So that certainly is a constant source of anger. And then we see that in housing, replicated in a number of ways where people are treated differently because of who they are. And that starts with the labeling, in immigration. We have folks who are undocumented and are treated really adversely, even though they're hardworking individuals and everyone is a human being. And in rental housing, we see renters who, again, whether it's because they receive Section 8 or because they've always rented, there's this I think, incorrect assumption that renters are sort of just lesser humans or lesser individuals. And that always makes me really upset.
Well, let's talk about those terms with like tenant and landlord. With tenant, with the Latin root, where it's having to do with to hold on, to grasp, and going so far back in time. Tell us about your thoughts on tenant and the whole kind of origins of this system we have now.
Yeah, after doing the rental housing legal practice for a number of years and just observing this, in and out of court, where there are both professional lawyers and judges bringing this sort of, and also the players, the renters and the owners or operators themselves, that they all have this sense that those terms, landlord and tenants, and fit, but they bring with them such baggage, and they are very ill-fitting. If we want to get to a place where people are treated, fairly and humanely, I think we need to stop calling people, in these sort of anachronistic or archaic terms. It really does sort of start there.
So, how do we get the word landlord? Lord of the land.
You can trace it back at least to the Middle Ages, and the king being the head of the state. All property was owned by the king and the crown, and lords, literally the noble men and women, were charged. Really, the noble men.
I was just going to say, not too many women.
They were given lands at the grace of the crown. And those lords would then bestow them upon their peasants, right? And then you have a development of, working the land and doing these types of agrarian things, also going to war, mustering the peasants who work for a particular lord to fight, countless wars and things like that. And really, there's an economic underpinning there too. Quite honestly, an economic exploitation underpinning. And it's just fascinating to me, without getting into the history, because I am not a historian by trade. So I'm glossing over this for full disclosure. But we in the United States try to get away from that sort of system. We haven't had a feudal system. As a matter of fact, the whole notion that there were colonial governors, right? But people could come and they could stake their claim and they individually could have land. That's really central to my understanding, at least, of what, people came to America for, was to get away from this sort of feudal society where your ownership could be, wasn't ownership, and it could be taken away by some lord who just had possession due to birthright, and that birthright just being bestowed by the crown.
So how do we get from that original feudal system to a situation, let's say in Chicago, where you have a landlord and renters who can't make rent and all kinds of problems? And it's obviously not having to do with anything agrarian. It's, in the middle of the city, let's say it's an apartment that's not being kept up well, and, all kinds of sort of struggles between tenant and landlord. How did we get from that earlier system to to now?
I think part of the way that we get to a problematic system in urban urban settings and small and medium city settings is partly due to not broadening our horizon and understanding of a real sort of true rental housing relationship. You know, when we refer to a property owner or operator as a landlord and the renter as a tenant, it just, you know, it's reinforced with this, you know, hundreds of years of history and this sense that, again, that one side is lowly and that the other side is somehow noble. And so we get there, I think, again, because the... because people in power are loath to relinquish power, and calling oneself a lord, it sounds nice if you're on the lord side of things. So no one ever really relinquished the term landlord, or thought to call themselves a rental housing business person, right? And what we see is, as a matter of fact, with most of the larger developments and even smaller developments, is that you actually don't even have the owner involved. So I sometimes will say owner and renter, but that's a bit of a misnomer too. I like this sort of sense of calling the person that most renters interact with the operator. Because what we have is folks who have still, once again, either inherited property or been lucky enough and blessed enough and privileged enough to make money and purchase property, not just for themselves to live in, but to help house others. So they have so many properties that they can rent them out. Again, to have that type of wealth and that type of luck and privilege means that you probably can afford to hire someone to operate your rental property for you, but you have this naming convention where, again, there's this sense that all renters need to be respectful and take whatever it is that the lord of the land is giving them, and this just sets up an imbalance. Imagine if you went to any business, walked into any store, any restaurant, you know, and you wanted to, as a customer, you wanted to purchase something, and you were told, no, like, that's not right. We're going to charge you more. We're going to tack on extra fees. The whole underpinning of so much of the normal business practice is that the customer is always right, serving the customer. And we don't have that in rental housing because we've never switched to a business relationship. We have just carried this baggage, this unequal baggage, an assessment that there is a lord who gets to do what they want, charge extra fees, charge extra, you know, and insist that the lowly renter or tenant must comply. So frustrating that's carried through. So that's how I think we get to certainly a lot of the problems, is we stop seeing the relationship as one that's mutually beneficial. Full disclosure, I own rental properties. I would never want to alienate my customers.
So what would you call yourself if you're not going to call yourself a landlord?
I'm a fan, again, of operators, I think, as a category of term, because that encompasses the hardworking people who do property management as their day job. And as an owner of rental property myself, I operate the rental property. I don't have a middle person because I just have one rental property.
And would your customers be just called your renters, but you would avoid the term tenant?
I would. It rhymes. It rhymes with and harkens back to peasants. Mm-hmm. And that is not the case at all. In Madison here, I've been lucky enough to rent to numerous PhDs, and those folks are smarter and more qualified and wonderful people. Not just the folks with three letters after their name, but all of my renters are wonderful human beings themselves. And so I think that of them, you know, renter describes what they're doing. They're renting, and so I don't find that there's a negative connotation with that term. So that's usually the term that I'll use. technically sort of mirroring the employer-employee terminology. Sometimes we'll refer to folks as lessees and lessors, just like employers and employees. That can also work, although it gets a little bit confusing when you get into sub-lessees because then the lessee becomes a lessor.
So are all renters, do all renters have a lease? I mean, it's, so a lessor implies that you've signed a lease. Yeah. But then some people just rent for the month. So
you're getting me into, I can talk with great excitement about the technical terms within Wisconsin law. So here in Wisconsin, we recognize what's still called a tenancy. Does not require a lease. It does not require a written lease. So you can have an oral agreement to rent, and that is just as valid as any other agreement. I like to point out to folks who think that you need a written lease that you can go in, again, to any store and purchase just about anything or order a very nice meal, and they don't present you with a contract, but you still have to pay for those goods. Same thing is true with your rental apartment.
It's different, though, when we think of somebody who does like a Airbnb or, you know, that somehow has a different kind of atmosphere around it. When somebody goes to Maine and stays in someone else's house, that's very different than renting from a landlord.
Yeah, I mean, the Airbnb situation is a unique one, or more recent one, in which we're really seeing again, private owners of property working to basically provide hotel-like services. Generally, if the owner isn't present, there's also, you know, Airbnb sort of started as a, you know, sleep on my couch sort of arrangement, right? But now more and more is just sort of replacing hotel stays and short-term stays for tourism and things. So that is definitely a different type of relationship. And again, where, as a matter of fact, you know, there are a lot of not good things about the Airbnb system. As far as driving up costs and pushing some folks out from time to time. But it does impress that there are reviews and there are there's a desire to treat customers well, right? And people are happy to stay there, and there's a relationship where each side realizes that they need one another. And in rental housing, in my day job, I just don't see that same sort of simple understanding and recognition. From all operators, many of them will just say, you know, we'll just evict this family or this person, and we don't care. We'll get somebody else in. We don't care where that person goes or if they can find subsequent housing. And again, you would normally not turn away somebody who's willing to pay.
Well, and you think of another housing arrangement, which would be dorms, a campus dorm. Someone pays, they get to stay in a room that's not theirs for a certain period of time. It's not the same as having a landlord because the university kind of provides that housing, but it's just a different version.
Yeah, I'll just say briefly that maybe unsurprisingly, when the state created the laws that govern rental housing, they accepted out dormitories for educational purposes. So my practice, I can talk a lot about rental housing in the private market and even subsidized and public housing, all of which fall within our rental housing laws and codes. But there is an exception to most of that for dormitories.
Mm-hmm. We're going to talk more about the rental law in Wisconsin and some of the damage being done to people who are falling within legal inequities when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
The Ballad of the Landlord by Langston Hughes. Landlord, landlord, my roof has sprung a leak. Don't you remember I told you about it way last week? Landlord, landlord, these steps is broken down. When you come up yourself, it's a wonder you don't fall down. $10 you say I owe you? $10 you say is due? Well, that's $10 more I'll pay you than you fix this house up new. What? You gonna get eviction orders? You gonna cut off my heat? You gonna take my furniture and throw it in the street? Mm-hmm. You talking high and mighty. Talk on till you get through. You ain't gonna be able to say a word if I land my fist on you. Police! Police! Come and get this man. He's trying to ruin the government and overturn the land. Copper's whistle. Patrol bell. Arrest. Precinct station. Iron cell. Headlines in press. Man threatens landlord. Tenant held no bail. Judge gives Negro 90 days in county jail.
That's The Ballad of the Landlord by Langston Hughes from 1940. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Mitch, and we are talking about a humane right to rental housing. You know, it's interesting listening to that poem from 1940, when, of course, $10 was a lot more, but the concrete discussion of things that are wrong, you know, where you've got the roof that's leaking, you've got broken steps, and this, the renter is trying to get those things fixed and ends up, because he expresses anger, getting thrown into jail. I'm just curious, looking at that from a 21st century point of view, what do you see is still kind of very much with us?
We are very much still in the 1940s sometimes, yes. The leaky roof and the broken stairs resonate very much with the work that I've been doing for the last 14 years. We see rental housing, which gets run down because, again, it is a business, and some businesses can be run to maximize profit and, again, not realize that customers should be treated well. And so you often see money pulled out of buildings and pulled out of state, even by larger corporate entity property owners and operators. So what happens in those situations is this the withholding of rent. So folks will withhold rent. We see that folks coming to Wisconsin might have come from a state where that's allowed. In the state of Wisconsin, you can't legally withhold rent without risking an eviction unless a court has already addressed it and ordered you, giving you the ability to do so.
So if, for example, in Wisconsin, you're renting, there's no heat, the toilet doesn't work, you've tried to get your landlord to fix it, and nothing is happening, you still have to pay rent on time and cannot use rent as a leverage?
That's right. It's a really sad situation. But if all of those things were wrong and you withheld $10, let's say, of $1,000 a month rent, you could face an eviction the very next day. You could be given a notice for underpaying your rents, and the operator could sue you in eviction court. You would then have an eviction on your record for at least 2 years, if not 20 years, even if you prevail. So the only way to get authorization to withhold rent is to live in one of a few municipalities. Madison is one of them, Milwaukee another, Wausau another, but there are only a handful where there are city-authorized rent abatement procedures. Even those, though, require you to apply and get a building inspector involved and go through quite a bit of process in order to document this, and only then can you withhold. And quite honestly, even with a city order authorizing withholding, the operator could still sue in county court to have you evicted and then have that eviction stuck on your record.
And is that approach the one that's in Wisconsin but not in some other states? Is Wisconsin's approach, where you can't withhold rent even if there's good cause, is that the majority of states have that?
No, so it's a really interesting, you know, brief history on this. It used to be that you simply could not withhold rent, period. And then there became a sense that, you know, the relationship between owners and operators and renters, was more of a contract. And if a fit habitable place for living wasn't provided, then maybe a renter should be able to withhold rent. This became highlighted in an early sort of seminal Wisconsin case. It was a case that happened in the late 50s here in Madison on the Near East Side, a property on East Johnson, which still stands today near Tenney Park. The case is called Pines versus Person. And the Pines rented a property to, I think, four or five college students that when they moved in, the electrical outlets were shocking. You know, there were numerous different problems. They tried to get it, you know, sort of fixed up and cleaned up and literally realized they couldn't live like this. So they moved out. And, like I said, they didn't pay rent, so they were sued. And the suit proceeded all the way through the courts up to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, which realized and in a very eloquently written decision documented that up until that day, and the decision was from 61, that it was caveat emptor. It was buyer beware. If you were going to rent a place, you needed to inspect it, and you needed to ascertain as a renter if it was safe and fit for you and your family. That maybe made sense, and they talk about this, it makes sense when you have an agrarian economy where you're talking about renting a farm, and everybody on the farm has to work, has to have like sort of four or five different trades. They can, you know, work the fields, they can fix the roof, they can fix the steps, those types of things. But as we move to a more urban setting, and we started to create, you know, in the Industrial Revolution, housing regulations, we needed to have safe and sanitary homes. So you started to get regulations, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court recognized in the 60s that, you know, we can't have those types of regulations and not have some type of enforcement mechanism. So they recognized that it was fair for the renters to withhold rent if the place was unlivable, right? So it's technically allowed here in Wisconsin. The limits on that decision, though, are that it needs to be unlivable, oftentimes referred to as uninhabitable, which is a very vague term.
And who makes the determination?
Right. The courts do. And just like the folks in the Pines case, if you were to withhold rent today, arguing that something is unlivable about your unit, you could face a court case that could go on for years and go up to the Supreme Court, which you may decide, you know what, no, it wasn't really unlivable. Therefore, you can't withhold that much rent.
I'm guessing that every single person we would talk to would have a horror story about rental and landlords and circumstances, whether it's a security deposit that doesn't come back or a landlord that just bursts in to check on the place or things that don't get fixed and so on. What right now in Wisconsin, what kind of laws protect, first of all, the renter, but also protect the landlord? Because I know we've been talking mostly about renters as the victims, but you do have landlords who are trying to maintain a property and have tenants who are damaging it. Mm. And you know, that's got to be awful as well. So I'm just curious right now kind of where the law stands on it and whether you feel that the laws that are there, that you as an attorney, you're an attorney and you're working with people who come to the neighborhood law clinic, let's say, do you feel that the laws are fair, that they're humane, that they're workable as they are right now?
Well, you know, having seen it over and over again, I look for areas to improve because I believe in teaching the students and also our clients and even opposing parties that we need to do better. We need to treat each other more humanely because, as you said, we all have either experienced it ourselves or we know someone who's had a horrible rental experience, right? And so, you know, it's easy for me to get into the weeds of the rental housing regulation and say this one particular provision isn't right. And I'll gladly do that in a minute. But I want to back up and mention, you know, sort of an overarching thing that came to me when we did a presentation, a street law, if you will, presentation at the local high school. So we're talking about, you know, renting your first apartment to these high schoolers, and their teacher came to me at the break and said, you know, oh, you know, my partner and I are thinking maybe we'll buy like a 2-flat and rent it out. And I'm super curious, like, what are the licensing requirements and the training that you need to be a property owner? And I had to stop dead cold and almost laugh because there are none. And here's this young person who I know had to get her teaching license. Mm-hmm. I know they had to take exams. I know that they need continuing education credits. I know that they need to be certified. I know that they need, you know, a degree. And to own property, you need none of that.
So anyone can be a landlord.
Anyone can operate rental property. Anyone can own rental property. And you need no training. You need no certifications to do so. So if you want to teach someone's children, you need lots of licenses. You want to cut someone's hair, you need a license. You want to, you know, operate and call yourself a professional mechanic, you need certifications. You want to rent to those children, to those families. You don't need anything. You don't need any training whatsoever in the state of Wisconsin to own and rent rental property. And I think that's where there could be massive amounts of improvement if we simply said, hey, here is how you could be a good rental property owner. Start to recognize that this is a business and that you get better business when you treat your customers humanely.
So the high school students that you were talking to who wanted to know about what to keep in mind when they rent their first apartment after they leave home, what did you tell them?
Basic things that I would give advice to anybody, you know, and interestingly enough, they had, you know, several of them had moved around and already had those bad experiences that they mentioned and started to, you know, internalize already as teenagers that sort of a negative connotation of the property owners and operators and things. So I would tell anyone, you know, and I told them, you know, you want to, before you rent, take lots of photos. We all have phones. Take photos and videos of what you're going to rent. Look over any written lease. It's just as important as looking at the actual apartment that you see. We see a lot more done online, particularly these days. It's really good to actually inspect the property that you're going to rent. Many places are taking wonderful photos of a demo unit and using those photos for 5, 6, 7 years. You might imagine that the property doesn't look the same in 6 or 7 years, and it might not even be the actual unit that you're seeing photos of. So see the place, take photos of it before you move in, read the lease document if you get one.
Are there some, you know, lawyers are known for reading the fine print. You know, the rest of us often just sign because it's tiny print. It goes on forever and we just sort of can't cope with it.
Yeah.
Are there sort of certain tricks that landlords can insert into a rental agreement that you should sort of watch out for where you can get stuck then and you've signed something you didn't even know you signed?
So here's some good news. The answer to that is no. There are some good protections in Wisconsin against inserting any particularly onerous provisions. So that right to a habitable apartment, you can't waive that. The law won't allow you to waive that. A lot of other clauses, similarly, if you're a victim of a crime, in Wisconsin, there's a nice protection that says if you are a victim of a crime, you can't be kicked out because you're a victim. So you may see clauses like that put into your lease. Those leases are then illegal. And so that's why it's important to if you feel like something is sneaky or tricky in the lease that you have signed, to talk to a lawyer.
Are there clear laws in place as to what is the landlord's responsibility to fix? Because let's say you move into a house and the refrigerator breaks or some damage is done. Maybe teenager leaves the water running and there's a lot of flood damage. I mean, the whole issue of who has to fix what seems to be a tricky one.
It is, and here's where the law does not help too much. The statute in Wisconsin says that it is the owner's duty to fix and to maintain appliances that are provided. And then the very next section says that it is also the renter's duty to fix and maintain them. So you have this overlapping duty. The only, you know, slight bit of guidance is that the renter's duty to fix things is limited to those that are minor in relation to the cost of the rent. And as you might imagine, that's very open for debate as to, you know, what's a minor cost? Is it $100? Is it $400 that it might cost to fix? Is it $600 for a new refrigerator? There's no clear line there, but certainly it is the owner's responsibility. You can say that, and they could come back and say, well, it is also your responsibility as a renter. But definitely ask again, as I would teach property owners. And again, I think there's so much could be done with education to property owners. You want to treat your customers well. I had a situation where my renter's refrigerator broke. It was just the ice maker, and I went in and, you know, tried to fix the ice maker and got it working again, and then something else failed. And I was like, you know what? Thank you for letting me know and not just, you know, going through this and limping through. And I'm gonna buy a new refrigerator so that you don't have to like post, you know, that this is terrible, our refrigerator broke and nothing was done, which wouldn't be good for my business, right? You know, so I want to know right away. I want to take action, and I want to have that be progressive. That's just really common business sense. But again, when you have operators who are detached from owners and there's no training, you'll have a management company that is given a fixed budget. And when something unexpected happens, there's no money to fix it. So they're just going to put it off and delay responding because they have a profit incentive to either not pull that money out of their budget or because they literally don't have that budget. I have seen operators whose hands are tied because they have no money to fix things that they would like to fix for their customers.
So coming into the Neighborhood Law Clinic, what is the most common kind of complaint that you see from renters? I assume you mostly see renters, not landlords. If it's a neighborhood law clinic where it's designed for people who can't afford a expensive attorney and there's some kind of a lawsuit going on, some kind of a legal thing. I'm just curious, what is the, you know, some of the most common problems that you're seeing?
Yeah, the big three would be security deposits, the failure to get those returned or accounted for properly, uninhabitable homes, so conditions, again, the leaky roof or the broken stairs, evictions, and discrimination actually permeates all of those things, right? You may not get your security deposit back, or you may be evicted because of a discriminatory reason, right? Something might not be repaired, again, because of discrimination. So,
are you talking about racial discrimination in particular, or what kind of discrimination?
All of our protected classes and statuses, we see discrimination, unfortunately, in all of them. So we have seen racial discrimination cases that we've worked on. We have a case right now, and had a case last year in the clinic where source of income is a protected status. So where you work, how you earn your money, as long as it's legal, is a protected status. You shouldn't be able to say, you know, no one should be able to say, oh, you work for the NAACP. Well, you know, we're not taking your money. And it doesn't need to be racially connected. What we see actually is people who refuse to accept anyone who has received any type of assistance. This is money literally printed by Uncle Sam with that is good money, and there are people out there who are refusing to take it and saying we won't rent to you because you receive money from the government.
So you're talking about biases against people who are on some sort of welfare, we might refer to it as, and people who appear to be maybe an activist in, you know, when you mentioned the NAACP or something.
Right.
I mean, there used to be discriminatory laws on the books that could prevent someone from living in a certain neighborhood on the basis of race.
Right.
So we know that history.
Right.
And I think there's also been recent cases where somebody went to try to rent a house and was told it was, you know, not available. And then a white person went and did the same and was told it was available. So there's mm-hmm. documented examples of racial discrimination. What do you do in your clinic when you run into something like that?
Well, you know, we start every case with investigation and negotiation and try to work it out and educate folks. Give you a really good example. Folks who have lived all their lives with disabilities often do not have a good credit record. People who are of color often have a disproportionate arrest and conviction record. What that means is that the lack of training that owners and operators have had leads them to do a credit check and a background check, and they'll see, oh, this person stole a pack of gum. It won't say that, it'll say theft. Or they'll see, oh, this person has not enough credit, right? That's what the report will come back as, and they will turn people down. And, you know, just again, it's just basic education. The Department of Housing and Urban Development, so HUD, has started to put out guidance that if you do a criminal background check, if you do a credit check, you need to also ask for more information to see if, like, what you find is a relevant and valid reason to exclude people. But unfortunately, that is just slowly starting to trickle into common knowledge and practice. Instead, we just tend to see that any blip means move along, let's not rent to this individual. And that may be because they're disabled. It may be because they're disproportionately convicted. It may be because of race.
We're going to talk about evictions, which is the outcome of some of what you're talking about, when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. Fewer and fewer families can afford a roof over their head. This is among the most urgent and pressing issues facing America today, and acknowledging the breadth and depth of the problem changes the way we look at poverty. For decades, we've focused mainly on jobs, public assistance, parenting, and mass incarceration. No one can deny the importance of these issues, but something fundamental is missing. We have failed to fully appreciate how deeply housing is implicated in the creation of poverty. Not everyone living in a distressed neighborhood is associated with gang members, parole officers, employers, social workers, or pastors, but nearly all of them have a landlord. That's from the prologue to Matthew Desmond's book, Evicted. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Mitch, and we are talking the humane right to rental. You know, I found Matthew Desmond's book, Evicted, which won the Pulitzer Prize, really eye-opening in its study of Milwaukee evictions and, you know, just the whole relationship between landlords and tenants, the racial discrimination, the terrible heartbreak of eviction. And I'm curious, from your standpoint of working in the area of law, including rental law, what your take is on evictions and why it's so bad in this state.
Yeah, you know, Matthew Desmond's book was a seminal work, right? You know, Pulitzer Prize, he went and won a MacArthur Genius Grant. And I just want to draw your listeners' attention to similar sort of works and exposés. You can start with The Jungle with Upton Sinclair. Mm-hmm. And after it, we see regulation, smart regulation, that allows safer practices in meat processing to flourish. So we see, like, the FDA and the USDA created and expanded. You fast forward to Unsafe at Any Speed, Ralph Nader's seminal book, pillaring unsafe car practices. Following that, we see the creation of the National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration and requirements for more seatbelts and eventually airbags, and now we're all safer because of that. And you could go to Rachel Carson in Silent Spring, and we see the creation of the EPA and Clean Air and Water Acts and things. When we saw Matt Desmond's book, Evicted, come out, later that year, the Wisconsin deregulated rental housing. They took away regulations. They haven't enacted any smart ones in Wisconsin.
So hold on a second. They deregulated rental housing. Is that a bad thing, I assume, because there's no regulation of conditions or what?
Right. So the examples that I've given are ones where there were exposés, often award-winning exposés, that highlighted a need for smart regulation. Mm-hmm. I'm a lawyer and I love laws more than the average person, but I don't think that we need to over-regulate everything, but we need smart regulations where markets fail. They assist markets and they improve safety for everyone. one. So we need that type of thing. And what happened, unfortunately, in Wisconsin, which is where Matthew Desmond's research was based, is that they deregulated. And that is a nice way to say gutted rental protections for renters. They took away the ability for cities to do periodic inspections of the safety of homes. They took that away. They took away the ability for cities and counties to regulate the return of security deposits, to put requirements such as photos. For years, I practiced law, and cases in Madison were relatively few because if a security deposit was withheld, there was a smart regulation created by the city that said you have to provide photos of the damage. This allows the renter to say, oh, you know what? That's right. I did damage that closet on my way out, or I did, scratch that wall up. And if they come to an attorney, the photos are going to be the first thing you look for, and you can then resolve it. If you even had to get an attorney involved. That was a requirement that photos be provided in the city of Madison, and that was taken away. That there's still a law on the books, but it is an unenforceable law because the state said cities and counties cannot pass laws about the return of security deposits, even though the cities and counties where there are a lot of rental housing have a lot of expertise, a lot of owners, and a lot of renters who elect their city council to pass smart regulations. And so what we've seen is deregulation, and we haven't seen movement on the federal level. Desmond calls for a massive expansion of the Section 8 program towards the end of his book, or other federal relief. And I join in that call that would be a good thing, but we haven't seen that like we've seen with so many other wonderful works and exposés.
I was surprised in his book to learn that landlords can, in fact, sort of discriminate against women with children, that they can sort of avoid renting when they think that that would be a riskier group. And that although you said something about the protection of victims of crimes from being evicted, there were numerous examples that he cited in the book of battered women, where if a woman was battered and called 911 for help, those would be seen as nuisance called, and then she'd find herself out on the street evicted. Mm-hmm. There's case after case, often, disproportionately affecting communities of color, especially women.
Yes. Desmond has a wonderful line about how black men are locked up and black women are locked out.
Yeah.
And we see that not just in the Milwaukee area where he studied, but here in Madison as well. Vastly disproportionate number of African-American women who are evicted in relation to the population. And so I do say, there are laws to protect people, but the laws aren't always followed. And it's very hard to assert those rights in court, particularly when what's at stake is your home. So if you're facing a complicated eviction proceeding and you need to provide a roof over your own head and your children's head, I would, if it was me, I would be looking for another apartment rather than trying to call attorneys to try to find one that may or may not help me. And I say that as an attorney who lives to help folks in that situation. It is just the priority one is to make sure that your family is safe. And these eviction proceedings move so quickly. That was also sped up. After Matt Desmond's book came out, they sped up how fast evictions go in the state of Wisconsin. So that just, again, is sort of further movement towards inhumane housing. We could do so much either with grand large steps or with smaller steps towards making more humane rental housing.
Well, let's talk about that because we only have a few minutes left and we've been looking at some pretty gloomy stuff. And I think everybody can see that it needs to be better. You shouldn't have people out on the street facing eviction notices and dealing with landlords that don't meet their needs humanely. Mm-hmm. So what would you like to see happening that could happen, that's realistic and that sort of honors this agreement that you enter into when you're occupying a house that someone else is owner of?
Yeah. And then to talk about two things. First sort of smaller and the second larger, but both based in reality that I think we could do with the will, because there are good examples of this. The first is a right to redemption. Not only does it sound nice, a right to redemption, but Minnesota has it. So what I mean by a right to redemption is that a lot of evictions are filed because someone is behind in rent. And in Wisconsin, if you are behind a dollar in rent, an eviction can be filed. You can go to court and you can offer that dollar to the judge, to the property owner, and if they accept it, you can still be evicted. In Minnesota, if you bring the money that you owe to court, even though you didn't pay it on time, if you pay it plus those court fees, you cannot be evicted. You have a right to redeem yourself, to redeem your housing, to keep stability, and to completely fulfill the owner's financial interest, right? We're talking the rent and any court costs paid. In Wisconsin, you can still be evicted. In Minnesota, there's a right to redeem. That just to me is just so fundamentally basic. I don't know why every state doesn't have it, because as an owner, I want there to always be an incentive for folks to pay.
Sure.
As a court official, I want to not see people go homeless and then have to struggle to find future housing because they have an eviction on their record or to be on other services. As somebody who's not involved in the industry at all, I want lower taxes, and because people aren't pulling more aid because they're homeless and moving around. And I want my coworkers who might be renters to not be losing sleep, right? It's just so basically humane, and it impacts all of us, whether we're in the rental housing world or not, because of our coworkers and our kids, friends, etc. The bigger one, sort of similar to what Matt Desmond proposed. We saw, during the COVID pandemic times, the rollout of emergency rental assistance. We also saw a massive extension and increase in unemployment benefits.
And moratoriums where you couldn't evict people for certain stretches.
Yeah, and the moratorium is very divisive, right? I mean, I think it was a wise policy to flatten the curve, as we'd say back then, but and keep people safe. Property owners were screaming, like, I'm not getting any money. I need to, pay my bills, etc. And the answer is actually there in the unemployment insurance model, right? We realize that when someone loses their job, they may not be at fault. And so we give them insurance. We give them a payment so that they can pay oftentimes for their apartment, but also for their food, and keep stability in the community so their coworkers are there, so their kids are getting to school. Why don't we have a similar sort of system for rental housing insurance? It doesn't need to be an expansion of the Section 8 system where it's only for lower income people. It should be just like we all, like, regardless of your income level, employees pay into an unemployment insurance fund, and then there's money available if, something bad happens and you've lost your job. And the federal government just adds in money when there are crises. I think there should be a rental insurance system on a federal level, because what we saw during the pandemic was blips of money and then struggles to get it sort of facilitated out because everybody had to spin up a new program. And what I hope to see a lesson learned from that, which is we need a system in place because we know bad things will happen. We just don't know when. We don't know what the extent will be. But if we have an insurance system that will lead to stability, health, safety, right, for all of us, whether we're renters or owners or just, need our coworker, to commiserate with because maybe they rent and they're not worried about finding another place or facing an eviction because they were a dollar late.
We're going to have you back in 5 or 10 years and see if things have gotten more humane, if there's more redemption, if there's a better situation here. Thanks so much, Mitch.
Thank you.
My guest has been Mitch, and we have been talking about a humane right to rental housing. I'm Emily Auerbach. I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Year.